Broadcasting from Manhattan Beach and the World Wide Web, you're listening to CHSR, HealthyLife.net.
As a service to our listeners, this program is for general information and entertainment purposes only. CHSRHealthyLife.net does not recommend, endorse, or object to the views, products, or topics expressed or discussed by show hosts or their guests. We suggest you always consult with your own personal, medical, financial, or legal advisor.
Welcome. You're listening to Way of the Dreamer. This is Robert Mouse. This is where we affirm and celebrate the power of dreams, coincidence, and imagination in our lives. I'm my own guest today. I thought at this stage in my life, I'll give myself the opportunity to talk about a few things that I find help me to keep soul in the body that might speak to you also. I should mention perhaps that this is for me what some people call a rounded year, you know, a year where you get a zero in your age, and my age is 80. I don't know how it happened. The calendar pages seem to have blown away day by day, and they seem to be blowing faster and faster. And as I say that, I'm remembering long ago, I was at a book and author event at the William Penn Hotel in Philadelphia with an interesting crowd of well-known authors at the time, including a charming Brit named Eric Ambler. You may have read him. You've probably heard about him. He was a classic mystery writer, Coffin for Demetrius and other things. And he stands up and he says, my obituary has just been printed for the third time by the Times of London. I must say that announcements of my death have often been premature. And everybody, of course, started laughing. Well, I could empathize with Eric Ambler on many levels, because when I think back over my life, I was first pronounced dead, not by a newspaper, but by doctors in a hospital when I was 3 years old. I had come down with a bout of double pneumonia in both lungs in Hobart in Tasmania in a bitter winter, and they pronounced me clinically dead. I came back, and they said, perhaps with some embarrassment to my parents, oh, your boy died and he came back, didn't he? Which I made later the title of a spiritual memoir called The Boy Who Died and Came Back. So here I am, and I've been thinking about things, principles, maxims, ways of getting by, rules for doing things that have worked for me. And I'm going to give you a list of 12. I don't expect you to take this as any kind of set of precepts to be followed by you. Rather, I'd like you perhaps to be aroused or irritated or stirred by these suggestions to come up with your own for what works for you. So I'm going to give you 12 rules for keeping soul in the body. And they're not complete from my point of view. There are others. They could be stated different ways. But I thought that might make an interesting monologue in this particular program. So the first one is this. What you most need to know comes through anamnesis. Do you know that word? I learned after I first heard it, quite a while after I first heard it, that it is used in psychology. Some psychologists use it. But when I first heard it in my early teens, I did not know it, anamnesis. And I heard the word from an interesting visitor who turned up in that drifty state between sleep and awake, that hypnagogic state. Do you know that state? You probably do. You're not awake, you're not asleep, you're somewhere in between. And ideas might come to you, voices might come to you, you might get glimpses of the world around you, including things that haven't happened yet. You might feel that you are visited by spirits. Whether or not you're comfortable with the word, personalities, people living or dead, human or other than human, who might come to call or might just be passing by and be seen by you because your powers of psychic perception are great in this liminal state, threshold state. So I'm drifting in that state, and in my perception, I have a visitor who looks like a beautiful young man. And I know he's dressed like one of the ancient Greeks. And I know he comes not from Greece itself, but from the eastern end of the Mediterranean, perhaps one of the Greek colonies or one of the cities founded by the Greeks, somewhere like Syria or Lebanon today. And he talks to me for a while, and the key revelation, the key communication is the knowledge that matters to you comes through anamnesis. So I had to look the word up. It is an English dictionary. It's hardly part of a common vocabulary. And it means literally remembering. But as I got deeper into this, I realized that in Plato's school, for the Platonists, for the Neoplatonists, anamnesis, remembering, has a special depth. What are you remembering? You're not just remembering last time you went to the dentist, or last time you went to the library, or last time you had a cappuccino. You are remembering things that you know or knew on the level of mind, of nous, of soul or spirits, before you came into the body this time round. Things that you know or certainly knew before you came down the birth canal. I mean, in the Platonic view of things, we're given a chance to look at the life prospects in the life we're being given in this world this time round. We are given a paradigma, given a paradigm, we're given a pattern for this life. We agree on some level to the conditions of this life. But then when we come down the birth canal, we forget most of it. I mean, some forget all of it. Some forget a great deal of it. Everyone forgets something because it's very hard to enter the world remembering all the things that you might have been and done in a space between lives or in previous lives. The coming through the waters of Lethe, the waters of forgetfulness, in the Platonic myth of these things, we forget. So the knowledge that matters comes through remembering. And that was and remains essential information for me. And it's been dramatized and revived in my life at various times. I'll give you one scene, one story, in which I was reminded how important this is. I was living on a farm at the time. I had purchased the farm because of an old white oak and a red-tailed hawk, and was living with the land and watching the animals and the plants and dreaming of the early settlers of the land. And then one morning, one middle of the night, if you like, around 3 a.m., there's a banging at the front door. And I go to the door, surprised that someone would be coming around at such an unsocial hour. And there in the clear moonlight is a pleasant-looking fellow. He looks like a friendly chap. He doesn't look all that smart, but he looks friendly. He looks warm. And he said, I'm looking at him puzzled. Why has this fellow come calling? And he looks at me in the moonlight and he says, I come from my father's house, which is a strange way to talk. And I'm thinking, is he one of those Jesus freaks who comes around peddling religion at the door? As a sort of religious edge to it. And then he gives me a family name, and it's one of my father's Scottish family names, and I'm wondering if there's some connection here. And then very quickly, he shoots me between the eyes, so to speak. He says to me, what is your contract with God? And I'm thunderstruck. I mean, what a question. And if he's asking me this question, what is my contract with God? Does that mean I've got such a contract? And if I do, how can I have forgotten? Because I'm not aware of such a contract. Not then and there at 3 o'clock in the morning at the door of the farm. And at that moment, of course, I become aware that I'm dreaming. I become lucid. And I exit the dream. I don't know that I chose to exit the dream. I think I might have preferred to continue the conversation, but that was that. And that was enough, because it got me thinking again about that early message, anamnesis, remember what the soul knows, remember what you know in the level of mind. And then I went to it. I mean, I started looking at it a little more seriously. I meditated, I journeyed, I dreamed on the theme, what is my contract with God? Well, that wasn't really my language at the time, but what was my contract with the higher powers, with the counsel of my life, with the witnesses, with the advisors? So that's the first thing. I mean, trying to remember and act upon things that might be part of a life purpose that you agreed to before you came here. I've tried to do that. I mean, I decided eventually in that same period that I was really tasked by my own greater self to help people open to the larger life and the larger meaning of things and to their own life purpose by teaching them how to dream in a broad sense. My own dreams had been important all my life. I was having tremendous dreams, lucid dreams, wide awake dreams, dreams of that half-dream stage I spoke about. So I decided that in my life contract, as I understood it, doing more of this and giving the best of myself to it would be part of serving my life purpose. And I've been happy in doing that. It hasn't always been easy. It hasn't always been well paid. But it's been rewarded in the light of spirit I see coming on in people's eyes and in the sense that I am in tune with what I meant myself to be. I'm putting it that way, referring to a greater self who looks in on me and with whom I sometimes feel more in tune than at other times. All right, that was my first thought, my first rule for keeping soul in the body that has worked for me. The second one is this. And I first formulated it this way to a podcast host who said to me, what's the most important thing I've learned as a dreamer? And I said this. We are in the afterlife right now. And the host was stunned. Made a comeback. Wanted to hear more. You are in the afterlife right now. I am in the afterlife right now. How do you feel hearing that statement? I mean, do you throw it out? Does it shake you up? Does it scare you? Does it win your consent? What I mean by it is, as you remember more about the larger circumstances of life, as you meditate more, as you dream more, it might become clear to you that before you came into this body in this world, you died to another life. That being born into this world was, in fact, part of a process of dying to another world. I remember that, I think, very clearly. You say it's in my imagination, but if it is, it's the creative imagination building a myth for me that I can live by. I think I know that I died to a life before I came here, a life between lives, and of course to lives before that. And I think I know that when I leave the body in this world, leave the physical body and don't come back to it, you might leave the physical body every night in dreams, but you come back. The difference between death and dreams might be that in death you leave the body and don't come back, in dreams you leave the body and return. When I leave the body, when you leave the body in this world, I think you are born into another life. On one level or another, in one way or another, you're following the so-called Tibetan Book of the Dead, the Badu Todol. I mean, you go into the clear light or you don't. If you don't, you go into various Badus that might follow. There are many, many versions of what the life beyond this life is like, but most world religions, probably all of them, offer some kind of vision of a life beyond this one, and many people in their personal experience through dreaming and meditation and other ways get a glimpse of what life might be like on the other side and might receive visitations from people who have died in this world and are living on the other side. There are many reasons for accepting or understanding that death in this world is birth into another world. So that's what I mean when I say you're in the afterlife right now. You died to another life before you came here. When you die in this life, you're born into another. And if that becomes your own understanding in this respect is stronger than belief, because belief might be something you take on faith, might be something you receive secondhand from other people's opinions or writings or whatever. But understanding is to stand under, to stand with knowledge that you have through experience or through those who have experience you can really, really trust. So if you understand that you're in the afterlife right now, you might look at things with more of a sense of divine comedy And here's a story about that from my life. I was flying to London, where I have family, and I had all sorts of worries on my mind. I'd changed my life, and I wasn't being paid very well for it, and bills were mounting up, and I had concerns of that kind. And I'm getting on the tube on the train from Heathrow Airport to central London, worried. And as I board the subway car, the tube compartment, there's a roly-poly fellow in a tweed suit, looks a bit like Santa Claus in English country clothes, who looks at me and says, the Buddha says, walk on the bridge, don't build on it. And I'm astonished. I mean, first of all, the Brits don't talk to strangers on trains. They just don't do it. And secondly, this fellow who looks like Santa Claus in a tweed suit, quoting the Buddha, I mean, it doesn't seem to hang together. As I sit down opposite him, I'm thinking, he's just told me what I needed to hear. Walk on the bridge, don't build on it. See, it's about the fact that this life is a bridge, an intermediary stage, a bardo between other lives. You came from a life before you came here, you go to a life after it. Don't think this is a place to stop still or just build in a static way. It's a transition. This life is a transition. It's a transit. It's a transit stage. And I'm wondering what else he has for me, and we've sort of struck up a conversation. What he has for me is talk about his pleasant cottage and garden in Melbourne, where he'd be happy for me to visit and have a beer or a cup of tea. And I think this is a pleasant, jolly British fellow talking with a gregariousness and openness that is unusual for the Brits. But who was it? What was it that quoted the Buddha about walking on the bridge? I felt actually an everyday angel had sort of seized his vocal cords and used them to give me a message. Well, the message was about that idea. You're in an afterlife right now. You're between other like experiences. Get that right. Get that straight. You might approach things with more clarity, a more sense of comedy, and more grace. All right, a third of these rules for keeping more soul in the body. You dream in order to wake up. You dream in order to wake up. It's actually in the writing of ancient Egypt, which did a lot of dreaming. Reswet, we transliterate the Egyptian word R-S-W-T, and it was written in the hieroglyphs with the symbol of a wide open eye. It's just a sort of determinative symbol, but interesting that there's a wide open eye. Reswet is a dream. It's also an awakening. That's literally what it means. So there in the language of an ancient civilization is encoded, embedded, the understanding that to dream might be to wake up to a deeper order of reality, to wake up to the fact this world where you stub your toe against, you know, the wall is not the only world that there is. There are worlds beyond the reach of the physical senses, and they might be equally real. They might even be more real. And actually, you go to them in dreaming. In dreaming, you travel beyond the body, beyond ordinary reality, into other worlds, and you have real experiences. So you dream to wake up, and if you're lost to your dreams, or your dreams are lost to you, by extension, I will say, you may be in trouble. Every indigenous culture that I know about says it's bad karma, it's bad mojo. It's a malaise to have lost contact with your dreams. Because if you've lost contact with your dreams, it's because you've lost a part of you, a piece of you that is the dreamer. And that's trouble, because that means that you've lost a vital part of energy, of soul. You want to get it back somehow or other. So dreaming is central. Dreaming is waking up. And the fourth rule I've alluded to already, the dream world is the real world. It may be just as real, even more real than the waking world we consider reality and call the real world. Or they might both be illusions, but equally illusory, because behind both is a greater reality. That's certainly what the Buddhists say. You can put it one way or the other. You can say that the dream world and the waking world are both real worlds. You can say they're both illusory worlds. But there's a certain equivalence between them that we often miss. There are worlds beyond the physical. We have connections in those worlds. What happens in those worlds has consequences. or our waking lives, what happens in a dream world, what we do in a dream world, choose to do or not do, has consequences not only there, but that spill over into waking life. What happens in a dream world does not necessarily stay in a dream world, whatever you've been told. So that's the fourth rule for understanding and keeping more soul in the world. The dream world is a real world. Every indigenous culture I know about says that. In fact, they say in West Australia, the Madu, one of the Aboriginal peoples of West Australia, they say, oh, the dream world is really real, implying that the surface world, the physical world, might be something of a shadow world that is somehow less than real. And I'll give you one more, then we're going to take a break and we'll come back and we'll do the rest. This is number five, if you're keeping count. It doesn't matter whether you are or not. It's not a linear subject. But number five amongst these makeshift rules for keeping is this. Every time is now. Now. This is the now time. From this moment, all other times, past, future, parallel, can be accessed and shaped for the better. Now, of course, we rarely think about this or remember it in ordinary life. I mean, I'm looking at the clock to see how many minutes we have to go in the show and how many seconds before the break. But in a more fundamental sense, perhaps, it may be so. We have TikTok time, and to a greater or lesser extent, we are bound to it. But we're not, perhaps in a fundamental sense, the prisoners of Chronos that we make ourselves out to be. There is this larger time, this expansive time, and if you learn to operate within that, you might find you have access, as I say, to past, present, and parallel times, and you can make changes that will affect things for the better. All right, I'm going to draw a breath. We're going to take a break. You're listening to Way of the Dreamer with Robert Moss.
Where can you find out about dreams and the dream world? MossDreams.com. At MossDreams.com, you can find out about Robert Moss, his work, and discover the way of the dreamer. Read numerous articles and essays on almost every facet of dreams. Find out Robert's class and workshop schedule. Read reviews and so much more. Visit MossDreams.com to find your way of the dreamer. That's MossDreams.com.
Robert Moss has a deep engagement with the dream world, and now you can take a crash course from this master of active dreaming at your own pace. That's right. You can get Robert's eight exciting half-hour programs on a new DVD set called Way of the Dreamer. Share Robert's story as a dreamer and dream healer. This dynamic 3-DVD set can help teach you how to find your way through your dreams to realize your full potential. Don't wait to learn the practical dreamwork techniques that can help you understand how to attain better health, emotional stability, spiritual awareness, and more. Order Way of the Dreamer DVDs today from Amazon.com or MossDreams.com. That's MossDreams.com.
We're HealthyLife.net, reaching and helping a worldwide audience without hype, without shock, and without shenanigans.
You're listening to Way of the Dreamer with Robert Moss. I'm my own guest today. I'm indulging myself by giving you a bit of a monologue in this year of my 80th birthday with some precepts, some suggestions, some maxims, if you like, for keeping soul in the body and for perhaps living with more of a sense of divine comedy. So we got up to number five. I said the only time is now. We're up to number six. If you want to keep count, and you absolutely do not need to. Number six, what is in your way may be your way. Now, this is Stoic. I mean, this is Marcus Aurelius. We've all heard some version of this. We've probably all experienced some version of this. I'll say it again. What is in your way may be your way. The obstacle may be part of the path. You know, we've all had moments when we felt really blocked in life, knocked back,
step back, felt that there was a door that would not open, or a door that, even worse, is slammed shut in our face, and it might be very painful. The block might be losing a job, or losing a contract, or losing a relationship, or being betrayed by someone, or being abandoned by something. It might be as bad as that. Or it might just be the sense that there is something that is unyielding. Well, I had this sense of that kind of blockage at one point in my life. And I had set my sights on traveling in life in a certain direction. I had certain objectives at the time. And I felt that I was being absolutely held up, opposed, stopped. Now, such a block could be something that is going to require you to improve your skill sets, get truly prepared, do better, do more. That would be a useful kind of block. It didn't feel like that. It felt that there was something that was just relentlessly opposing my ambitions, my purposes. And I didn't sit down to meditate on this with any particular focus, but I was given a spontaneous vision in that in-between state, a reverie in-between state, somewhere between dreaming and waking. I suddenly was able to look at myself like an observer. And here is my second self, Robert. And here he is in front of a terrible, heavy door, old oaken door, studded with iron, looks like some medieval prison door. And he's banging his fists, and his knuckles are bloody. He's trying to open the door. It will not open. I'm watching this. Yes, yes, yes. This is just how it feels. Why am I being made to see this? Well, I get that sort of sensation of somebody looking at me. You know what it feels like. And I turn my gaze. I'm looking inside the vision. I'm looking inside the bubble of vision. And over there to my right, there is a magnificent arch. If I call it a golden arch, you might think of McDonald's. This is much better than McDonald's. There's a golden archway leading to visions of prosperity and love and abundance and beauty, all sorts of good stuff, representation perhaps of where I would like to be going. And standing in the arch is a very elegant but very tricksterish figure who is beckoning me, beckoning my second self. I'm still the witness, looking at this little theater, a stage, no doubt, for my instruction. And I'm watching him. And I see my second self moving towards the archway, and I'm beginning to move from my observer position into the scene and move with him. And yes, yes, this is the right entrance. Why the heck was he, were we beating ourselves bloody trying to open that door that would not open? And I see two things. While with one hand this trickster gatekeeper has been beckoning me to go through the archway of opportunity, with the other hand, he has been holding that door shut, because behind that door is a place of confinement. It's like a jail cell. Suddenly, in this theatrical revelation in my inner sight, I understand I've been pushing and fighting and struggling to put myself into a place of confinement. And that guide, I mean, I dropped the particular plans and agendas I had at the time. I recrafted my approach to central things in my work life and in other aspects of my life because of that vision. Well, the revelation doesn't have to involve a vision. You're stopped, you're blocked, you have to choose another direction. And that's how it plays out. It plays out on the literal plane, and it plays out, and you discover that what was in your way became your way. So, all right, number seven. This won't require a lot of explanation, just require encouragement to do it. Do what you love, and let the universe support you. We probably think of Joe Campbell saying again and again, follow your bliss. It's true. Find what you love, do what you love, give your best to it, let the universe support you. Sometimes you find that what you love becomes your work, your play. What you do for its own sake becomes your work, and it supports you in the most literal way. It gives you the material resources you need as well as everything else. But whether or not that follows, you're going to regret thing. You're going to regret your life profoundly if you put off or put aside what you yearn to do for its own sake. Do what you love for its own sake, and let's see how the universe might come along with you. Number 8, that courage, quality of the heart. And I'll give you the rule, and then I'll talk about a context. Courage is not the absence of fear. I'll repeat it. Courage, the quality of the heart, any place you find it, courage is not the absence of fear. It is the ability to go through fear because you are driven by something stronger, like love. And I'm thinking back to a moment when a good friend of mine was in danger of losing it. I mean, losing the most important things in their life because of fear. Fear of losing a job, fear of the judgment of work colleagues, fear of a bunch of things. And I was driving on a country road in a green landscape in rural Vermont, thinking about this person and what I could offer. And there's a little white church, probably a Congregationalist church, one of those Northeastern Protestant churches, not fundamentalist, civilized little church. And they've got a sign in front of the church, and it says, "Courage is fear conquered by love." I thought, yes, 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 that is the message for my friend and for me and for anybody I am privileged to talk to about these things. Courage is not fearlessness. We all know people, including ourselves, who like to say from time to time, "I am fearless, I was fearless, and this is praise, this is good." Well, it's not necessarily all that good, because to be fearless might be to be brainwashed, to be mind manipulated, to be on a high, drugged on something or other. The high might be on so-called patriotism or hatred or sectarianism or something like that. So to be fearless in that sense, to be fearless in the sense of being willing to go berserk, bear-sark, in a fight, is not necessarily something that we want to emulate or make our own practice. To be able to recognize fear and step through it in the cause of something stronger, that is courage. And that, I have learned, is a great way to approach the moments in life when fear opposes us but can be dealt with. All right, you're listening to Way of the Dream with Robert Moss. We are now up to Precept 8, Rule 8. We'll come back with Rule 9 after the break.
Robert Moss has a collection of books, audio, video, and DVD products that will help you bring the creative and healing gift of dreams into your everyday life. Revitalize your work and relationships and journey to the furthest reaches of your imagination. These books are tools that everyone can use to begin or enhance active dreaming in their lives. Visit mossdreams.com. That's mossdreams.com. MOSSDREAMS.com.
Since ancient times, indigenous people from every culture have used their dreams to help interpret their lives, the world around them, and the future. Now you can tap into this indigenous wisdom with Robert Moss's workshops and classes, all designed to help you learn more about you and your connection to the dream world. If you are interested in finding out about how to host a class or workshop in your area, email Robert at robert@mossdreams.com. Or to find out about Robert's ongoing schedule of classes and workshops offered worldwide, visit his website, mossdreams.com. Get your personal dream symbols and discover the ones you dream about in Linda McKenzie's Symbols of You, a new book available at Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Target, and more.
You're listening to HealthyLife.net, the radio network that brings positive talk with positive change to make your world a little better.
You're listening to Way of the Dreamer with Robert Moss. I'm indulging myself by riffing on the idea that there are some rules, some precepts, some maxims that might help us to keep more soul in the body and to approach life with more courage, more purpose, and have more fun at the same time. So I've got up to 8 of my list of 12 rules, and the 9th one is this. Your big story is hunting you. Everything changes when you let yourself be found. Your big story. Well, in my native Australia, the Aborigines say the big stories are hunting the right people to tell them. I love this. I quoted it at a writer's conference once, and everybody got wildly excited. Yes, yes, come to me, come to me. I'm waiting. Come and jump on me. I mean, the idea, actually, in archaic cultures, let's call them indigenous traditions, is that stories have their own lives. You know, a story has its own, is a spirit. A story is a spirit, has its own mind, it has its own intentions. It is actively, and the Aborigines say the big story is hunting the right teller, they mean the story, like a shark in the water, like a crocodile on the riverbank, like a sea eagle looking for the fish, is looking for someone to pounce on. And if your big story succeeds in pouncing on you, you'll be different, because it will probably displace the tawdry little personal histories, the tales of dysfunction and failure and family drama and all the rest of it. And if you're seized, then you're going to be animated and you're going to have the potential of healing through myth. Think of Joe Campbell again, Joseph Campbell, who said that healing is what happens when we move from suffering into myth. Myth, mythos, the bigger story. Let it take charge. So this is a good thing. Well, how do you let yourself be caught by the bigger story? Well, it's good to put yourself in a place where you're easy to find, a border place, you know, between the tame lands and the wild woods, dreaming of such a place, that hypnagogic half-dream state, reverie, meditation, wandering the world, being open to the play of synchronicity, which is when dreamlike symbols pop up all around you, being open to finding the world speaking to you. The Aborigines also say that everything is talking. You live in a speaking land. The tree is talking. The lizard is talking. Even the Toyota is talking if you pay attention. Being ready to hear, to smell, to sense the speaking land around you, whether it's in a gritty downtown part of a city or whether it's out in the wild nature. Listening to the land, listening to the breathing animate land. That's another way of putting yourself in a place where the big story can find you. Number 10 are these rules for keeping more soul in the body. The stronger the imagination, the less imaginary the results. I've been saying this for years and years. I always thought I was quoting Tagore, Rabindranath Tagore, who's a very good person to quote. I'm not, actually. He said something similar, but this exact formulation is mine. So I have to allow, I have to accept the fact that it's an original statement. Tagore did say something different, similar, and he understood with his poetic clarity. The stronger the imagination, the less imaginary the results. I mean, we see this on all sorts of levels. Let's think about the somatic level for a moment. A lot of people in medical science these days accept, after early resistance, that if you have a strong image, strong feeling or thought in your mind, in your heart, your body will believe it as if it's a physical event. I mean, that's one example of this. The body will receive your images as their physical events and respond accordingly. And this is actually increasingly important in some aspects of healing. We discovered very early on that it works in pain relief. It was discovered quite strongly along the way that it works quite well in oncology. If you give a cancer patient the right image, the shark to eat the cells of the disease, for example, when sharks rarely get cancer in regular life, you're giving them an ally in healing in addition to all the other medicine you might be giving them. So the ability to develop a really strong visualization of something, project it into the world and then maybe just let it go off pop without worrying about the consequences. I mean, this is part of the way of creative living. So
The stronger the imagination, the less imaginary the results. Number 11. Don't leave home or return to it without your sense of humor, right? One of my early lectures, long, long time ago, decades and decades ago, there's a guy who put his hand up and said, bottom line for me, what is all of this about? And I said, well, you know, I differentiate people between those who have a sense of humor and those who don't. He said, why? I said, I think you're in the wrong room. Why don't you go out the door, go along the corridor and see if the place, the class that you need to be in is waiting for you. Oh, you're kidding. Oh, I never joke. And he's looking around and people are laughing. He doesn't get it. We have to keep our sense of humor. Against laughter, said Mark Twain, who kept his sense of humor, nothing can stand. He can stand. Against laughter, nothing can stand. It's worth quoting Mark Twain, not only because he's such a great humorist, but because his life actually floated on a black underground river of tragedy. Terrible things happened. It's like terrible, terrible family tragedies with his brother and his daughter and other people who he lost. He lost his brother in exactly the way that he had dreamed it. He didn't understand dream precognition at the time, but he lived to see the consequences. He lost his daughter and wondered always if they could have changed the dream afterwards. But he lost all his money. He went bankrupt because of somebody who he financed to build a typesetting machine, which was slow and didn't work properly. And each time he bounced back. And his sense of humor was part of his bounce back. We sometimes notice that great comedians are also people who are dealing with, containing, redirecting energies in a way that, you know, that brings out comedy rather than tragedy. I think we can all, each of us, reach a point in life where we have to choose comedy or tragedy as our genre. And I strongly recommend choosing comedy. Comedy in the original definition, as in the Commedia, Dante's Divine Comedy, means something that is of the people, that people can understand, that is in language that is comprehensible, and is something that has a happy outcome. That's the original meaning of comedy. So I recommend approaching life, if you can, in the genre of commedia, in that dual sense. Communicate with people in a way they can understand. Speak their language. Don't speak down to them or up to them. Speak, find your common basis for discussion. Use the right words. Use the vernacular. And that will vary according to whom you're with, of course. Ask. Look for the happy ending. A comedy as a literary form might start with terrible things, but it will end out with everything coming out okay, with some kind of happy ending. And then the 12th of these maxims for life. It comes from something I was told at a critical moment of my life by the kind of inner voice you learn to trust and heed when it speaks to you. This world is your playground, not your prison. I mean, by that kind of inner voice, a crisis time in my life, crisis of spiritual emergence, one might call it. Robert, this world is your playground, not your prison. I was stunned. It's very hard to accept that sometimes, isn't it? When bad things are going on, you're in grief, you see people around you being abused and hurt in all sorts of ways, and your life isn't going so well. But, hey, suppose it is a divine game and you're part of that game. Suppose you can carry on in that spirit. Give it a try. You won't lose by doing so. All right, we'll come back, and I'm in danger of telling you some more stories because that's how I learn and that's how I practice. And I think I have one or two that you might enjoy. You're listening to Way of the Dreamer with Robert Moss.
Robert Moss has a collection of books, audio, video, and DVD products that will help you bring the creative and healing gift of dreams into your everyday life. Revitalize your work and relationships and journey to the furthest reaches of your imagination. These books are tools that everyone can use to begin or enhance active dreaming in their lives. Visit mossdreams.com. That's mossdreams.com. mossdreams.com.
Since ancient times, indigenous people from every culture have used their dreams to help interpret their lives, the world around them, and the future. Now you can tap into this indigenous wisdom with Robert Moss's workshops and classes, all designed to help you learn more about you and your connection to the dream world. If you're interested in finding out about how to host a class or workshop in your area, email Robert at robert@mossdreams.com. Or to find out about Robert's ongoing schedule of classes and workshops offered worldwide, visit his website, mossdreams.com.
HealthyLife.net, where positive overcomes negative.
This is Robert Moss. You're listening to Way of the Dreamer. I hope you enjoyed those 12 suggestions, rules for keeping more soul in the body. You'll find them written up in a very brief form in my Substack account. If you haven't found my Substack, go look for it. It's quite active and it's quite eclectic. It's all over the place. I'll write about things I have learnt about dreaming and about life, and then I'll write about how things were done in medieval China. Actually, my most recent piece is about something I found fascinating, reading a book about the Ming Dynasty in China. You know, in that period, the time of the Ming, high officials were in the habit of commissioning artists to paint pictorial autobiographies. And what this meant was that the high official would select scenes from their lives, you know, like being present with the emperor at a particular event, or like presiding over a truce between rival generals, or going through an important wedding, or going on a trip to another country, or crossing a river. The Chinese were always afraid of crossing a river successfully. But then in some of these pictorial autobiographies, the Chinese high officials selected events from their inner life as well as their outer life as the important stories to be recorded. And I wrote about one high official of the Ming who chose three dreams from his life, together with about 24 episodes from his physical life, as the substance of the pictorial autobiography. The artist was to paint these 27 or so images, including the three dreams. And what makes it even more astonishing is that one of the dreams shows very clearly what he thought was going on in dreaming. It shows him in a crisis of illness, wrapped up under every warm covering he can find. But in the garden outside, his second self, his ghostly subtle body, his ghostly dream self in its subtle body, shown as looking like him but smaller, is drifting in midair among the trees above the flower beds. It's actually on the way back to the body from which it's been expelled by illness. So it's a dream about healing, but it's also a scene that reveals how the Hun, H-U-N soul, an aerial soul, in several Chinese systems of understanding, is separable from the physical body and the body soul that keeps it going and can travel on its own and might sometimes get lost or wander too far away and have to be called back. So I was thinking how clearly it reflects the different mindset, the different understanding of a culture from our contemporary Western culture, to actually depict your high court official, the high official of state. Can you imagine a government minister in a modern Western country talking about this, let alone having a picture made of a dream in which their second self, their dream self, is shown traveling beyond the body? And yet I don't know that the spiritual anatomy of these things has really changed very much in the tens of thousands of years that Homo erectus has been on the planet. I don't know that we're that different. I don't know that our brains are that different. But above all, beyond brain and body, I'm not sure that the structure
of our psycho-spiritual life is really all that different, even if we don't understand it anymore. What early cultures are joined in is the view that when you go dreaming, part of you actually goes, part of you travels. Call it the dream soul or the dream soul. There are different names for it. Some cultures call it the ghost of the living, because when this part of you is beyond your physical body, it's a bit like a ghost of the departed. And indeed, you find it very easy to interact with spirits of the departed. So they say that one of the key things going on in dreaming, which is not recognized by most Western psychology, which tends to review, if it values dreams at all, it tends to review dream contents as parts of the dreamer. What's this showing about this aspect of the dreamer? How does this reflect a complex or neurosis? How does this relate back to the dreamer's relationship with their mother? What does water symbolize in the emotions of the dreamer, etc.? All of that, it's not completely disregarded in older and indigenous cultures, but it is secondary. The secondary importance, what's of primary importance, is the understanding that in dreaming, and dreaming can become a conscious practice, it's not just a spontaneous phenomenon, as lucid dreamers today are trying to make it. In dreaming, you make visits and you receive visitations. When I first talked about my dreams of an ancient Iroquoian Arondiwano woman of power who called me to her from that liminal space between dreams and awake. When I first talked about that to an elder of the Six Nations of the Longhouse of the Iroquois people, he said very matter-of-factly, oh yes, you made some visits and you received some visitations. The old wisdom, the old understanding in dreaming, we're not confined to the body or brain except by our lack of imagination or our lack of willingness to accept the truth of our own experience. In significant dreams, part of us goes traveling or it receives visits from other travelers. There might be other dreamers, they might be the departed, they might be angels or gods or spirits or daimons or devas of nature. I mean, it's all possible. And that's the ancient and indigenous understanding. And in my life as a teacher of dreaming, this is something I've sought to bring back. I'm not pushing aside all our modern ways of dreaming or all our methods of psychotherapy or all our analytical ways of looking at these things, they're relevant too. You know, if you've been shrunk to death by a Freudian, you'll probably have some Freudian dreams. If you followed Jung, you'll probably have Jungian dreams, and Jung, of course, was quite open to some of the things I'm talking about. But at the end of the day, here we are in this world, but it's one of many worlds. We stand or sit or lie right now at the center of a multidimensional universe, which might include any number of parallel worlds where some parallel version of us who made different choices is doing different things. We are connected to realms where the dead are alive, but connected to realms of healing and initiation and higher education in the kingdom that is called the imaginal realm in the Islamic mystical imagination, which is a good name for some of this. And all of this unfolds for all of us, at least in potential, every night. This is one of the beautiful things about dreaming and dream work. We all have some material. It's open to everybody. Not everybody is going to want to do it. Not everybody is going to be equally good at it. I mean, you might be born to be an Olympic skier, but if you're like me, you most definitely were not. You might be born to be a world-class dreamer, or you might have a more limited facility. But everybody, to a greater or less extent, has access to the riches of dreaming, and everybody has access to what will come to you in that drifty in-between state if you'll just practice a little relaxed attention, and what will come to you on the roads of everyday life through the play of synchronicity. Once again, if you're willing to open yourself and pay attention and step out of headphone land for a moment, and let the speaking land speak to you, in which it's trying to communicate. So I guess I turned this show into an even stronger invitation than normal to take up the three things we have so often dismissed: our dreams, the power of coincidence or synchronicity, and the power of imagination, and weave them into a life more juicy, more strong, more connected to worlds beyond the ordinary one. You're listening to Way of the Dream with Robert Moss.
Since ancient times, indigenous people from every culture have used their dreams to help interpret their lives, the world around them, and the future. Now you can tap into this indigenous wisdom with Robert Moss's workshops and classes, all designed to help you learn more about you and your connection to the dream world. If you're interested in finding out about how to host a class or workshop in your area, email Robert at robert@mossdreams.com. Or to find out about Robert's ongoing schedule of classes and workshops offered worldwide, visit his website, mossdreams.com.
Robert Moss has a collection of books, audio, video, and DVD products that will help you bring the creative and healing gift of dreams into your everyday life. Revitalize your work and relationships and journey to the furthest reaches of your imagination. These books are tools that everyone can use to begin or enhance active dreaming in their lives. Visit mossdreams.com. That's mossdreams.com. MOSSDREAMS.com.
HealthyLife.net, where positive overcomes negative.
Well, thank you for joining me. This is Robert Moss. This is the Way of the Dreamer show. Tell your friends. We can build our audience, and there are many people who are hungry for what we are offering but don't know what it is yet. So, as you go forward on your roads of soul, may your doors and gates and paths be open, and may the doors and gates and paths of any who wish to do you or those you love any harm be closed. May it be so.